So Sean asked me to give the talk. How does LIGO work? And I solicited a few opinions about exactly what this meant. And I think the best opinion I had from Chris was, could I explain LIGO in a way that he could explain it to his mother-in-law? So. So that's what I'm going to do. So Amy, you might want to take notes. Okay. So what I want to do is basically go through and give people an introduction to the advanced LIGO detectors with an emphasis on, you know, where we are now, how we're going to get to, you know, where we want to be at design sensitivity, what is design sensitivity, but also what knobs do we have to turn in the detectors that will allow us to change the sensitivity of the detectors. Because one of the things Luis asked on Monday is, you know, in this program, can we be a little bit forward-looking and really figure out, you know, what science and astronomy and astrophysics can we wring out of the second generation detectors? And, you know, what problems do we really need, you know, detectors beyond advanced LIGO, advanced Virgo to solve? And so that means understanding a little bit about what's the flexibility in the design of advanced LIGO, what things are, you know, we'd have to throw the mirrors away and buy new mirrors, what things could be tweaked on kind of a, you know, 5 to 10 year time scale to wring a bit more sensitivity out of the current generation detectors. And then I'll talk a little bit about the analysis and the observables for binary neutron stars. And then Ajith is going to talk tomorrow about the some of the questions that people asked about waveforms, templates, things like that. And then more the analysis side of things. Okay, so how does LIGO work? So let me grab my notes so I get some numbers correct. So pretty much, so I'm going to talk about advanced LIGO, and I'll illustrate some of the differences between advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo. So for those of you, just to give a recap of the plan, advanced LIGO is 3 gravitational wave, broadband gravitational wave interferometers. The baseline plan is for a 4 kilometer detector in Hanford, two 4 kilometer detectors in Hanford, and a 4 kilometer detector in Livingston, Louisiana. The thing that's currently going on right now is the plan to basically move this to India, and so we'll have 3 gravitational wave detectors in 3 different sites. So if the National Science Board approves the LIGO India plan, then we'll have LIGO will have 3 observatories operating around the world, with 1 in Washington State, 1 in Louisiana, and then 1 in India. Obviously, moving the detector to India will delay the construction and operation of the Hanford 4 kilometer detector, because there is no Indian observatory at the moment. If the National Science Board approves that, that will put a delay into this interferometer. So LIGO will be operating with 2 until LIGO India comes online. But there's a 3rd interferometer in Cascina, Italy. So this is Washington in the US. This is Louisiana in the US. And then this is Italy. There's a 3rd interferometer in Italy. So this is so the LIGO Scientific Collaboration and Virgo operate this group of interferometers.
GSV is meeting this week. Do you know, is there an estimate of how long it might take?
I was talking to a GTF yesterday, and I think the decision is expected by the end of the month. So that we'll know during this workshop whether or not LIGO India is going to happen, which is going to be interesting. Or whether we'll get two detectors in Hanford. So that's the baseline plan. You may also have heard another LIGO Scientific Collaboration detector is GEO-600. This is a shorter detector, slightly different optical configuration. GEO Although there's a plan to improve the high frequency sensitivity for GEO to maybe catch supernova explosions nearby, as far as we're concerned for compact binary coalescence, GEO is not really astrophysically sensitive to the sources we're interested in for binary neutron stars, neutron star black hole, or black hole. GEO basically prototypes advanced detector topologies for these detectors. So in terms of actually thinking about sky localization for compact binary sources, we typically don't fold GEO into the mix. There is also a detector, CAGRA, which is the WAS LCGT, Large Cryogenic Gravitational Wave Telescope, that's in Japan. And that is coming online. You know, it will probably be a gravitational wave detector. That CAGRA has some differences with LIGO. It's underground, which means they have to drill tunnels, which they're doing right now, which puts a huge physical plant burden on them. There's some desire to prototype some technologies beyond what we're using at Advanced LIGO and Virgo, in particular cryogenic optics to lower the thermal noise on the mirrors. I'll talk about that in a bit. So they have some challenges here. I would expect this to come online on the same timescale, maybe between when Hanford and LIGO India come online with an advanced LIGO type sensitivity detector. So even though this is on the ground, it's not third generation beyond advanced LIGO. It's a similar detector with a similar sensitivity to advanced LIGO and Virgo.
Okay. So I heard both stories about CAGRA regarding seismic noise. So the idea was you're going to put this instead of a giant mountain. So the seismic noise would go down at low frequencies.
Right.
I've heard explanation that this is because, seismic noise falls off rather fast as you go down.
Right.
And I've also heard a story that's not quite true if you're on a mountain.
Yeah, so Stefan just got back. Stefan Barmer just got back from the CAGRA review. He's going to talk about third generation stuff in a bit more detail during the conference, but you don't get the, Einstein telescope, the proposed third generation detector is underground to damp down the surface seismic stuff. CAGRA doesn't benefit. The reason CAGRA is underground is because it's in Japan and there's not really much space. You can go 4 kilometers that way and 4 kilometers that way without going into underground. So you don't really get a huge amount of, you don't get the ET type seismic low frequency suppression if you go into a mountain. You got to go actually underground to get that. So you can think of CAGRA basically being, even though it is underground, being a similar sensitivity detector to the advanced detectors.
So what do they gain by adding cryogenics?
Let me talk about advanced LIGO first, and then I'll talk about some of the limiting noise sources, and then that will explain what.
So I've heard a story that CAGRA is supposed to have the same sensitivity as LIGO-ish.
Right.
But then, if they're adding cryogenics and they're going to snap cryogenics, I mean, that should gain you something. But anyway, we're going to go with this.
Yeah, that's. Let me go through LIGO first, and then I'll talk about CAGRA.
CAGRA is also 4 kilometers?
I think CAGRA is 3. Okay. 3 is the plan first. So this is 4 km. This is 4 kilometers.
Virgo's
3 kilometers as well. So Virgo's 3 kilometers.
So if anything, it should be much better.
And actually, I put 4 kilometers question mark because some people are talking about making LIGO India even longer. And then this is 3 kilometers. But the baseline plan is for 4 kilometers in India. Okay. So what are these? How do these detectors work? And what do they look like? Well, they're laser interferometers. So basically, they are glorified tabletop Michelson interferometers with incredible sensitivity and controls. So start with a laser source, shine it in against a beam splitter, goes up to a mirror up here, comes to a mirror down here, and then put a photo detector right here and measure the light coming out. So this is an N-test mass, TMX. N-test mass, ETMY, and then a beam splitter in the middle right here. And as you have what you're looking for with this is a phase shift caused by the gravitational waves. So the gravitational waves will induce a strain on the detector, So you have some delta L over L as a gravitational wave passes that looks something like H over 2 cos omega T, where omega is the frequency of the gravitational wave. So that's the physical effect of the gravitational wave passing the detector. And what you're actually measuring is you're measuring a phase shift on the light caused by the change in length of these arms. And the phase shift, delta phi, is given by the time it takes the light to traverse the interferometer, 4 pi divided by the laser length, the variation delta L, delta T. So the optimal storage time in these interferometers is to basically have, if you have a gravitational wave incident on the interferometer, it's going to stretch one arm, squeeze the other arm. If it's coming from directly overhead, if it's coming down one arm, then the effect of the gravitational wave is going to be null on the direction of propagation, and it's going to stretch and squeeze the other arm. So you can see immediately there's a directional response to the gravitational wave detectors, right, from the two polarizations. Coming overhead, you'll stretch in this direction, squeeze in this direction. Coming down the arm, there'll be no effect in the direction of propagation, so no effect on this arm. You'll stretch and squeeze this arm as the gravitational wave goes past. So there's directionality in these detectors. So they are, you know, and of course if you come along the diagonal, then the stretching and squeezing in the two arms is identical. There's no relative change in the length of the arms, and there's no phase shift on the light. There's no signal leaking out of the dark port. So you end up with a sensitivity pattern that looks kind of like a, if these are the arms of the detector, you end up kind of with this peanut-shaped sensitivity pattern where you have the most sensitivity to gravitational waves directly above and directly below, half the sensitivity if the source is positioned on the arms, and then varying sensitivity in different directions.
I was just curious, is there any reason why you wouldn't want to put two sort of on the diagonals? In terms of, because if you don't, you could tell the difference, and you can't measure because they're identical if you actually had detector on the diagonal.
If you built another interferometer, rotated 45 degrees, and you have a more sensitive network, but that requires building another interferometer. So, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's the cost. I mean, that's effectively.
I should know this. The Hanford 2 one, was it at a different angle?
The Hanford 2 was not at a different angle. The Hanford 2, because so the physical, I should have actually shown some pictures of the sites, but the physical Planck construction for these is non-trivial. LIGO is an observatory facility, right? And detectors go in the observatory facility. So when the observatory facilities were built, that means basically, you know, pouring concrete, leveling out these arms, having a vacuum beam tube that is spiral welded 4 kilometers, you know, world's largest vacuum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For the physical plant for these detectors for 4 kilometer long vacuum arms. The Hanford 2 detector in initial LIGO was a detector half the length that was in the same vacuum envelope as the Hanford 4 kilometer detector. The reason for doing this when LIGO was designed was that a gravitational wave signal would be, you know, of strength H in the 4 kilometer detector and H over 2 in the 2 kilometer detector. And so you could distinguish a noise source from a gravitational wave signature by saying, well, is the amplitude in the H2 detector a factor of 2 less than this? Whereas noise sources might be expected to have random amplitude distributions. That's great in principle, but if you are trying to build a detector that's, you know, as sensitive as possible just to reach the first sources and see out there in the detector, you don't really want to make your detector a factor of 2 less sensitive if you can help it. So the baseline plan for H2, if India doesn't happen, is 2 4-kilometer detectors, unlike initial LIGO. So there will be no 2-kilometer detector in advanced LIGO.
The peanut doesn't go to zero.
That's because I can't draw a 3-dimensional peanut. There's an orientation where there's a null.
Okay, so there are nulls.
Yeah, there, and you know, it looks kind of like a peanut, but it has nulls along the diagonals for a single detector.
Can you give us a relative sense of the cost of the vacuum and versus the instrumentation?
I think I can give you order of magnitude estimates. I think the facilities are in the order of 300 to 500 million. I think the detectors are a factor of two less than that. So
well,
it's not.
The numbers you can use from the numbers that LIGO is asking India to put in. So the facility, so the US gives all the electronics, the mirrors, et cetera, they are supposed to build the facilities. The facilities, I think the estimate is $140 million.
Right. Sorry, I got it the wrong way around. It's the facilities are actually cheaper than the enterprise.
It's probably cheaper to build the facility in India than. Yes.
Hopefully. Okay. So these detectors have a beam pattern, which because they're directional detectors, the two LIGO detectors are aligned as closely as possible in order to maximize detection. So up to the curvature of the Earth, the orientation of the beam patterns of the two LIGO detectors are as identical as we can make them, given that one's in Hanford and one's in Livingston. So the arms of the two US LIGO observatories are aligned. Virgo actually has a different alignment, which provides additional coverage on the sky. Virgo was basically placed where they could place it. It's in Italy, it's in farmland. They placed it where they could place it. And Kagra has a different orientation again, but the two LIGO detectors are almost aligned. Sky localization is gained primarily from triangulation of the source from time of arrival on the network. Okay, anyway, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. Let me.
The units of the last equation you have, dimensional.
There is no dimension.
Isn't there time? Well, there is lambda, which cancels, and dt is time.
Yeah, that's right.
And phase is dimensionless.
I'm missing a C in here, aren't they? No, my DL over L, yeah, I'm missing an L in here, aren't I?
Over L
times. Yeah.
And then
a C, yeah.
C is
one. Hang on.
Yeah, we this is the, you know, one of the things that we ask for people like to have C there.
So delta L is dimensionless. Yeah, so I'm missing astro people and their G's and C's. Yeah, that's right. Okay, anyway. Where are we? So on the construction of the detector, if you look at the gravitational wave phase coming in here, the optimal, in order to have the detector with the most sensitivity, you want the gravitational wave storage time to basically be half a wavelength, right? So you want to accumulate half a wavelength in here, basically come out half a wavelength, and then come back. So you want the light storage time in the arms to be half a gravitational wavelength. If you have longer than that, then you start to cancel out as you see the other period of the gravitational wavelength.
I didn't follow that point. Could you try that again?
Okay, so you have a gravitational wave propagating through the detector like this, right? It's going to cause a relative change in the length of the two arms, right? What you want is the light is going to come in here, it's going to come up one arm, come back to the beam splitter, come here, recombine and come out to the detector. Okay, you want in order to get the maximum phase shift on the light, you want the light storage time in the arms to be half a gravitational wave cycle, right? Because in the first half of the period, the length changes and the second half it contracts. There's a phase inversion between the two arms. If you store the light for a whole gravitational wave cycle, you basically cancel out your signal. If you store it for half a gravitational wave cycle, you get the maximum phase shift on the light. Right? If you're talking about gravitational wave frequencies of around 100 hertz, which is what we're looking for in ground-based gravitational wave detectors, then you find that the arm length that you want is something like 1,000 kilometers. So that's just calculating that's half the wavelength of the gravitational wave. Building these detectors with 1,000-kilometer long arms is pretty difficult, and so what you want to do is make the arms appear to look longer than they are, and so you put a mirror in here and a mirror in here, and so you set up a Fabry-Pro resonant cavity. So this is the inner test mass, and the light bounces between these two cavities, and the number of bounces is about 200. So you bounce the light about 200 times between the 4-kilometer arms, and then you get an apparent arm length that's comparable to half a gravitational wave cycle. So that's resonant recycling in the arms. Then the gravitational wave comes back towards so you have the gravitational wave signal coming out here, you have the carrier coming back towards the laser. In order to increase the sensitivity of the detector, the sensitivity of the gravitational wave detector here is basically limited by counting statistics of photons arriving at the photodetector. You want to measure a phase shift, and you measure that phase shift by counting photons here. So there's a quantum mechanical process here that limits the sensitivity to the detector. So if you're you have the uncertainty relationship in measuring energy and time, the energy is related to the number of photons, arriving at the photodetector, and that's a Poisson process of the arrival of photons arriving at the photodetector. So the phase shift is related to time. So if you want to measure the phase shift, you have the uncertainty relation here. The energy you're measuring is the uncertainty here comes from the uncertainty in the number of the arrival of photons at the photodetector. So this basically limits the sensitivity of the detector. What this says is if you want to measure the phase more accurately, you need more photons arriving at the photodetector. So if you want more photons arriving at the photodetector, you want more incident light coming into the interferometer. And so what you do is you put a power recycling mirror here that reflects the wasted carrier light back into the interferometer and makes the laser light look more powerful. And so you have in advanced LIGO, the plan is to have a 100-watt laser that gets power recycled to give circulating power in the arms of order of hundreds of kilowatts. So that's basically the initial LIGO detectors basically look like that. That was the optical design in the initial LIGO detectors, power recycled Fabry-Pro interferometers. In the advanced LIGO detectors, when the gravitational wave is instant in the detector, you have the effect is basically, if you look at the frequency.
Putting that mirror doesn't have the effect of making the interferometer longer?
The power recycling mirror?
Yes.
No, that doesn't have the, it basically, because the signal's not resonant in this part, so the power recycling, the PRM is just to recycle carrier power back into the interferometer. There's another mirror down here, the signal recycling mirror that I'm going to talk about in a second, that basically recycles the signal in the interferometer, and that enhances the signal extraction. So if you have the laser light in the interferometer at a frequency FC, 1064 nanometers, the wavelength of the laser light, the effect of the gravitational wave passing through here is to put audio frequency sidebands on the gravitational wave on the light in the interferometer. And the way it's read out is you allow some of the carrier light to leak out towards the photodetector, that beats against the sidebands from the gravitational wave, and that gives you the signal at the photodetector here. You can actually put another mirror in here, the signal recycling mirror, that causes the gravitational wave sidebands to also be resonant in the interferometer, and that then builds up more signal power in the interferometer. You can think of it like, you want the arm length to be half the gravitational wave frequency, but if it comes back out, flips the phase, goes back into the other arm, it's going to see the other half of the gravitational wave out of phase. You're actually going to build up phase shift for the whole phase of the gravitational wave signal. Okay, So that's basically the kind of rough outline of how how LIGO works. How does that translate into detector sensitivity? So let me clean this diagram up a little bit. So we have a bunch of fundamental noise sources coming into the detector. So we have the light incident on the detector, hitting the beam splitter. We have the Fabry-Perot arms right here, Fabry-Perot arm right here, and then light signal recycling mirror, and then light coming out on the photodetector. In order to keep this interferometer stable, in order to keep this interferometer stable, all of these loops basically need to be resonant. You have a Michelson interferometer right here, you have the power recycling cavity, you have the Fabry-Perot cavities for the arms, you have the signal recycling cavity. So there's a digital control system that keeps all of these loops stable, keeps the light resonant in the detector, builds up the power in the arms, and so there's a piece of the interferometer that's kind of, when you sketch out these diagrams, there's a piece that's missing, which is basically all the photodetectors that pick off the various loops, go into a digital control system, and feed back to the mirror positions, and keep everything stable and locked and resonant so you can actually detect the gravitational waves. And then the gravitational wave signal is the output of the, it's basically the error signal in the feedback control loop. So.
It just moves the end mirrors, not all the others?
No, depending on exactly what the control, the LFC loop just moves the end mirrors, but the depending on what the control loop is, it moves this control on all of the mirrors. Yeah?
What is the distance from the power into the...
This distance here?
From there to the power?
From the laser to the power recycling?
From the power to the...
From the power recycling mirror to the beam splitter, it's order 10 meters. Okay. It's in the... All of this is in the corner station building. Oops, sorry. And then there's the 4 kilometer long arms, then end station buildings with the end mirrors in.
So the 10 meters is not affected when we're doing the delta L over L, the 10 meters does not play a usual role?
No. The signal's accumulated in between the inner test mass and the end test mass. Okay, so I haven't yet got to the actual sensitivity. So the output of the detector, the readout is basically, once it's calibrated, is a strain signal, let me call it S of T, which is the product of various different noise sources in the detector plus hopefully a gravitational wave strain in the detector. And the noise sources in the detector, if you look at them in the frequency domain, so if you look at the power spectral density of the noise as a function of gravitational wave frequency, it's limited by three fundamental noise sources. So the first of these is seismic noise. And seismic noise is the limit on the motion of the mirrors at low frequencies just due to coupling of ground motion, other motion into the mirrors themselves. So the difference between advanced LIGO and initial LIGO, one of the key differences is better suspensions of the mirrors. So in advanced LIGO, you have multiple stages of isolation of the mirrors. You have an external isolation system that acts to, so these are active seismic isolation systems.
Okay.
Yeah?
So how far underground do you have to go in order to decrease the seismic noise?
How far?
Underground.
I think it drops very quickly. If you want to go and...
What? Intuitively,
why is it that it drops so quick? So the noise source that affects you if you're actually on the surface of the Earth is actually it's basically compression and rarefaction of the rock changes the mass distribution nearly, and so you get Newtonian noise sources. And so you actually get the mirror just moving because there's Newtonian gravitational attraction between mass distributions. You get that from the air. And you get that from the compression and rarefaction of the rock from surface seismic waves. I don't know what the skin depth of the Earth is for those surface seismic waves, but it doesn't take very much to get beneath those until you're actually in a level where. So it's not just the, you know, that's the, it's the primarily the surface waves that are the problem. And so going underground, you get underneath those. Yeah.
And the surface waves, the problem is that you have a big discrepancy of the density above and below the ground. As soon as you go in a little bit, then you significantly kill that conclusion when there are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any theorists, I don't know what I'm talking about, but like in Hanford, if you had both Hanfords that were 4 kilometers and like you connected the two end mirrors, would there be any way to like cross correlate and remove seismic noise? Something like that? Is there any way to play games instrumentally like that?
And the stochastic group are trying to do, you know, noise cancellation in the detectors using, you know, H2 and H1, but the signal and the noise are both correlated, right? So how do you know that you're just removing the noise and you're not removing the signal? Or how do you know that it's just all noise? So, you know, having H1 and H2 in the same place in the same configuration has advantages and disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is the environmental noise sources are going to be correlated with those two detectors. And removing those,
I mean, your signal is phase coherent, but the stuff you're trying to cancel out is a bunch of random phase, like a stochastic noise. So I agree, like a stochastic signal, where do you know, but if you have like a coherent burst or something.
Well, if the noise in the gravitational wave detector was purely Gaussian, so the noise would be completely uncorrelated, then yeah. But the problem is there isn't just Gaussian noise, there's non-Gaussian noise sources. And so you're looking for a burst signal.
I forgot it's a real detector.
Yeah, in a background of, yeah. So in principle, if the noises were Gaussian uncorrelated, it'd be fine. But the fact is they're in the same place, so the noise is correlated.
Yeah. You can construct a null stream that shouldn't have any gravitational wave signal. And then if usually non-Gaussian stuff will show up like that. Mm-hmm. So you can sort of use that to excise bits of the stream data.
That's a pretty effective veto. In fact, the burst group have done everything coherently, and so they've
constructed null streams
to get rid of those noise sources. So they say, okay, let's cancel out the gravitational wave signal. And then what's left is just noise, and so we'll use that to veto anything that was in the gravitational wave channel.
So these null streams don't get
No, if the detectors are in exactly the same place.
This is the easiest possible scenario. So it's just a simple linear combination.
But you can always construct null streams if you only have one detector, right? If you have several other detectors, the company, the output of certain themselves, standing and other people at MIT,
then
I've not heard about the idea of just using a single detector and constructing null streams.
Well, no, it's two detectors. It's H1 that we're asking about H1, H2 on top of each other. Yeah, yeah.
But as soon as you break, as soon as you don't have them sensitive to the same polarization, then you can't do it with two.
Right.
But don't you need to share a phase meter and the mirror?
You have to calibrate both detectors so that there's no sort of a strain. So any error in that is going to be a problem. But if you keep that at a few percent or something.
Okay, so the advanced LIGO detectors basically have the improvement over initial LIGO is there's active seismic isolation. There's two layers of active seismic isolation on all the detectors. So we are above ground, so we have various different seismic noises. You can basically think of these, so in the initial LIGO detector, the seismic isolation was passive. So it's basically just coupled pendula. So every pendula gives you a 1/f² suppression of the noise. And so ultimately you get, you know, a curve that looks like this that gives you noise suppression at just from mass and spring and mass and spring and mass and spring of the noise suppression. In advanced LIGO, yeah?
I was about to ask, so in initial LIGO, how many was it? I don't actually remember. Was it just a single pendulum?
No, it was because the seismic, so you have, you know, the thing that never gets drawn is the tables that the pendula are sitting on, and they have, you know, there's seismic isolation stacks that look like this, where you have masses and basically springs between these masses, and then then the suspension here sits on top of that with the mirror on top of there.
But it wasn't a single cable image on LIGO, was it? That's holding the mirror?
So initial LIGO was a single cable holding the mirror, right? So that's one pendulum, but it sat on top of a bunch of pendula. Right, so each one of these guys gives you a 1/f² suppression of the noise. There's a Peter has a nice picture in his book of the actual suppression systems, and they're basically just metal discs on rubber things and metal discs on rubber things. In advanced LIGO, this is now, you know, they're actually the double pendulum system for the mirrors, and then these sit on top of, instead of passive seismic isolation. There's a table here called the ISI table, which is an active seismic isolation, which has sensors that measure its inertial motion and then feedback to cancel that out. And then this stage here sits inside an active seismic isolation system that provides additional pre-isolation before it gets to the ISI table and gets into the couple pendula, and then this is the actual test mass right here. So the reason I kind of talk about this is to illustrate what is, you know, facility fixed and what could be variable if we want to improve sensitivities. The seismic isolation is pretty much facility fixed, right? The ISI tables, when they're fully working, and that's a question of, you know, how long is it going to take to, these are active, so there are servo loops here that actually have to be debugged and tuned and make and reduce the to reduce the noise at this stage. And then in the external pre-isolation, there are servo loops here that have to be debugged and tuned to reduce the noise at this stage. But then, and then there are also, you know, the suppression of the actual mass suspensions themselves. This is pretty much fixed, right? You're not going to get a huge amount of, in advanced LIGO, there aren't a huge amount of knobs to control without going in and doing major upgrades to the detector to change the low frequency noise. That's why people are talking about third generation going on the ground, things like that.
So is the limit as to how much you can reduce the noise in the seismic 10 hertz?
Let me give you the actual. I actually print out the noise curve, so I could give you the actual numbers for advanced LIGO. I have the.
I guess my question is: do you have to go underground, or could one add more, like a triple pendulum, quadruple pendulum? I understand that those things are fixed now, but.
Well, one of the things people are talking about for pushing down to, you know, 2.5, 3G without going underground is more active seismic isolation. So seismic arrays that measure the distribution, Vukmandika and Rana and Adhikari have talked about this, to put more active seismic isolation in, so you have more isolation to get down to lower frequencies.
So there is no limit, money is the limit in this effect.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure the main advantage of going underground is gravity gradient,
yeah.
which seismic isolation doesn't help with, right? It's just the matter distribution, time-dependent matter distribution.
Well, that's what Vuk's experiment in, he's getting pretty ambitious with the gravity gradient noise, which is to actually try and suppress that
by measuring
the distribution. And so he has an experiment in Dussel, which is basically an array of seismometers, and he's looking at whether or not you could actually do something to cancel out that gravity gradient noise by having you know, not just inertial sensors on a table, but an array of seismometers that would let you cancel out some of the lower frequency stuff. So that's kind of one of the things that's being pushed for 2.5G, maybe getting better low frequency sensitivity without having to drill, you know, 10 km ET tunnels, kilometers underground. But again, that's not something that we can say, you know, if only we had 5 hertz instead of 10 hertz, we could do all this stuff. The commissioners can turn a knob and make it better and say, okay, we can do it. That's a non-trivial extension.
The gravity gradient noise is where is it within this? Is it part of the site? Are you?
Yes, so I'm including gravity gradient, everything in seismic. So
it might have a different power law.
And it does.
It goes below our current thermal noise.
It so looks like. Drop. Yeah, it looks like. Let me make this a bit bigger. Otherwise,
it's
going
to get
confusing.
Actually, you're able to measure.
Oops.
I don't know.
Let me draw this bigger, otherwise it's going to be.
I And eventually, even if you put more active seismic insulation, you would hit this out of there.
Yes.
And then you would that.
Yeah.
That would be like a one hertz.
It's the least of slope.
Give me a frequency.
A low frequency least of slope.
Yeah, what's the frequency at which the two curves intersect?
The seismic, the...
The coefficient.
It is 11 hertz.
11 hertz.
Right, so you have...
Least is a lot further away from the sources of the gravity gradient, but the slope would be the same.
Sure is. This is a, this is displacement sensitivity. Goddamn experimenters. This is in meters per root hertz. So let me get the numbers right here for you. So the blue curve is the seismic noise, and that basically comes down. So this is 10 hertz. So the blue curve basically hits 10 to the minus 22 at 11 hertz and comes down like that. So that's the seismic limit. And then the facility limit, which is combination of the residual gas and the gravity gradient noise looks like that. And this is basically what limits you at low frequency, right? It's the seismic that limits you at low frequency. Okay. So the next fundamental noise source, which is one that again is difficult to change in the advanced LIGO detectors, is thermal noise on the mirrors. So the mirrors have a substrate which is fusilica, so it's basically glass. And then in order to set up the interferometer, there are coatings basically on the mirrors that give you the reflectivity you want for the various different mirrors. You want the ETMs to be highly reflective. You want transmissivity in the inner test masses to let light in the arms and bounce around, so that you have mirror substrate and mirror coatings. Those have losses due to thermal noise. And that is really what limits you in the most sensitive region. So the thermal noise sensitivity from the mirror coatings looks like... basically looks like that, where this is 10 to the minus 20 meters per root hertz. So in the middle of the sensitivity region, it's thermal noise that limits the sensitivity of the detector.
Can you explain that? So what is it about the coating? So they have a heat capacity or something?
So the mirrors, there is absorption in the mirrors and the coatings, and so you have. So there are two types. There are two types of thermal losses, right? There's just Brownian noise on the mirrors, right? So you have, you're trying to measure the position of this mirror to an accuracy which is comparable to the amount the atoms on the surface of the mirror are jiggling around. So if you have a large spot on the surface of the mirror, you can basically average over those Brownian thermal fluctuations to get an average mirror position and cause yourself to be less sensitive to those. There's also losses between there's absorption in the mirror coatings and then the substrate, and when you have absorption, you have loss, and when you have loss, you have noise again from the fluctuations. So those are physical things that are characteristics of the mirror and the coatings, and you can't really change the thermal noise. You can change the spot size fairly easily, but not dynamically within LIGO. And so once you have a spot size, a choice of mirror coatings, a choice of mirror substrate, your thermal noise is basically fixed for that interferometer.
I mean, so that's the idea behind the cryogenic cases is that they're actually in a cooler.
Yeah, so the cryogenic case, the idea is, so there are a couple of ways that people are thinking about going beyond the thermal noise in advanced LIGO. One is cryogenic that CAGR is pursuing. They're the first people to actually try doing large-scale cryogenics in a gravitational wave detector. No one's ever tried that. Then the other thing people are talking about is changing the mirror substrate from fusilica to silicon, which has, you can have crystalline coatings and less losses. You have crystalline coatings on the mirrors rather than amorphous coatings on the mirrors, and so you have less losses there. But that is, that's a, you know, beyond what people, the reason I'm kind of bringing this stuff up is there's people are now thinking, you know, okay, there's advanced LIGO and then there's ET, right? But there's kind of this air in the middle that people are thinking more seriously about now that, well, you know, something like ET is, you know, 10 years away in the sense that Lisa can be 10 years away. And so what can we do? You know, what can we do in the existing facility? I mean, the situation with ET now is there is no funding in the US or Europe to pursue coordinated large-scale research for a third-generation gravitational wave detector. It's basically the university research groups who are looking at different bits and pieces, but the ET funding basically expired after the design study, and there's basically a gap in ET funding to take them forwards beyond there. So what people are thinking about now is what can we do with the existing advanced LIGO facilities to upgrade the sensitivity of advanced LIGO without going to ET, going underground. So one of these things is, okay, it would be a non-trivial upgrade, but maybe we can take out the few silica optics, put silicon optics in, that would give us better thermal noise, and that would basically lower the thermal noise down here. But again, that's talking about an upgrade that's comparable from, not maybe all the way from initial LIGO to advanced LIGO, but it's another thing that is non-trivial.
So why did the thermal noise run up right against the acoustic? Why are they so close to matching?
So down here, there's basically a resonance. This is actually the resonance of the suspensions that comes down like that. So you tune the resonance of the resonance of the test masses, because there's vibration thermal noise as well in the wires, and this is tuned so so it's basically you push that out of band.
So the low frequency hum in initial LIGO / initial LIGO 1.5 was because of one of those three, presumably, right?
The low frequency in initial and enhanced LIGO was so initial LIGO was basically 40 hertz, and it was the seismic isolation. There was less seismic isolation in initial LIGO, which gave it a 40 hertz low frequency cutoff. And then the active seismic isolation and the better mirror suspensions advanced LIGO pushed this down to 10 hertz. But you know, getting down to 10 hertz, you know, these are design curves, is going to be tricky. There's always low frequency is always hard, and so pushing this down towards the low frequency is going to be difficult. So you know, when I'm doing studies of, you know, advanced LIGO, I typically use a 15 hertz low frequency cutoff, because it's probably going to be, you know, noisy, glitchy stuff down below 10 hertz that it's going to be difficult really to push all the way down there.
So something about the unit. So this is something where you integrate this current, this quantity over some range of frequency to get in. You write the noise up here as terms of a strain.
Sorry, I was copying because I wanted to get the numbers correct, and I printed out the differences. You'll see differences depending on which audience people are talking to, right? So if you're talking to analysis people, then they'll typically quote things in power spectral densities, and so they'll quote power spectral density, which has units of strain, which is dimensionless, strain squared per hertz. That's the power spectral density of the noise coming out of the detector measured in strain, right? So you have a dimensionless strain coming out. Calculate the power spectral density of that, and you basically have a quantity that's strain squared per hertz. When people are doing studies in interferometer, they typically use displacement. So the strain is delta L over L. They typically use displacement, which is in meters. And then they also talk about amplitude spectral densities rather than strain spectral densities. So if you Fourier transforming quantity that's in meters, your power spectral density would be meters squared per hertz. The plot I'm copying from is an amplitude spectral density of displacement, and so it's meters per root hertz. Make sense? Okay. So the last fundamental noise source in the interferometer is basically the shot noise that limits you at higher frequencies, and that's basically proportional to the laser power. So the more, that's what I was talking about earlier about the the quantum mechanical shot noise that comes in. The higher the laser power, the more sensitivity you have to the phase shift, the more sensitive your gravitational wave detector. So you have, it's a little bit subtle, because if you do the calculation just from the uncertainty principle, you find that it's basically flat and proportional to the laser power. But once you filter that through the actual interferometer, you get a noise source that rises up at higher frequencies. And so a combination of radiation pressure and photon shot noise gives you a quantum limit. Where are we? It's the deep purple curve. That is slightly higher. Is this? That is slightly higher than thermal in this region, goes below thermal, and then comes back up at higher frequencies like that. So there's two pieces here. One piece of this is basically the shot noise limit, which is the proportional to the laser power, the light incident, and the interferometer. And then another piece of this is radiation pressure. So you have two quantum noise sources that compete with each other. As you turn up the laser power, you have more light arriving at the photodetector, you have more photons to count the phase shifts, you have more sensitivity to the phase shift. So as you turn up the laser power, the sensitivity interferometer increases at higher frequencies. But as you turn up the laser power, you have more photons hitting the mirror, so you have radiation pressure pushing on the mirrors, and that gives you a noise source at lower frequencies. So you have a quantum noise source, which at low frequencies is the radiation pressure, which rises as you increase the laser power. So the noise at low frequencies increases as you increase the laser power. As you increase the laser power, it decreases at high frequencies as you get more photons arriving at the photodetector. So you have the quantum noise source is the sum of the radiation pressure and the photon shot noise. And so you have a balancing act there to get the best sensitivity coming out of the detector for a given input light.
And how strong is the change? Because you know where I'm going. If one really wants to get a lot more sensitivity on the very high frequency side of things, like at kilohertz for merger,
right.
So why it just doesn't happen, would you lose a lot to the point that you may not even catch the signal?
For binary neutron stars?
Yeah.
It's not that bad, but there are ways of beating this down without, so the way to get this down without suffering the radiation pressure is squeezing, right? So you can squeeze the light going through the detector, and that's actually been demonstrated in practice. So the thing we probably have the easiest handle on is to increase the high frequency sensitivity with squeezing. That's probably going to be the first upgrade to the advanced LIGO detectors beyond the design plan.
Does that buy you?
Depends how much they can squeeze the light. I think they demonstrated in Hanford a few dB of squeezing, but it's not, you know, orders of magnitude more sensitive down here.
Squeezing, you mean
squeezing? So the light in the interferometer, you have an electric field that has an uncertainty in the amplitude and the phase. By squeezing it, basically preparing the light in a quantum state where you have more uncertainty in the amplitude than in the phase, but you don't violate the uncertainty principle overall. But that's something that could be done to increase the detect sensitivity at high frequencies, and that's probably going to be the first, you know, major. And it's kind of cool because there's a black box you just hook up to the interferometer, and you put squeeze vacuum into the interferometer, and it increases sensitivity, and that's been demonstrated up at Hanford.
Yeah, but I thought the story was if you did that, then you're in this squeeze configuration that sort of like lowers the noise at high frequency, you lose a lot of low frequency, so you won't catch the spiral.
That's tuned signal recycling.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's a couple of other knobs, right? So signal recycling allows you to shape this noise curve in a non-trivial way by causing the gravitational wave sidebands to be resonant in the interferometer. And there's different configurations of squeezing depending on the reflectivity different configurations of signal recycling depending on the reflectivity of the signal recycling mirror that you can either do a detuned, basically broadband signal recycling, which enhances the gravitational wave signal across a broad range of frequencies, or you can do a tune to a specific frequency, and so you can increase the, that's the noise curves. I think the noise curves, you know, you've seen noise curves that look like that. Is that what you're thinking of? that's tuned signal recycling, right? So you're doing signal recycling and tuning it to specific gravitational wave frequencies.
So to do that, then you need to replace a signal recycling mirror?
Yeah, you need to either change the reflectivity of the signal recycling mirror, which means changing the mirror, or you can tune it by changing the distance between the signal recycling mirror and the, you have a degree of freedom with a signal recycling mirror, which is, you know, if you look at the image of the power recycling mirror and the beam splitter, the signal recycling mirror can vary with respect to that. So by varying the length of the signal recycling cavity, you can tune the signal recycling cavity. That's different from squeezing, right? Squeezing basically just brings down the shot noise broadband It brings down the shot noise, right? It reduces uncertainty of phase, so it brings down the shot noise all the way across the band.
Am I thinking about it right? If you do the squeeze light and you bring things down to the point where you're quantum limited, then there's a limit to your calibration because your amplitude uncertainty. You can't know where that noise sensitivity is exactly because you don't know the amplitude of the, you don't know the number of photons.
No, you're measuring you're measuring the phase, right? So you basically.
But you can't measure the radiation pressure through the phase any better than your knowledge of the amplitude of the light that's hitting the mirror.
I'm not 100%. I mean, squeezing is a way to beat the standard quantum limit. The standard quantum limit sets the shot noise limit. And by squeezing, you can basically do better than the standard quantum limit by pushing the uncertainty into the quadrant
right,
you
so
don't care about.
The phase much better, but then as far as the radiation pressure that's pushing on the mirror,
your signal's in the phase, so you don't care about the other one.
Well, but as a noise source, you described it as the photon sitting in the mirror.
Right.
The way, I guess it's. I don't see how that's the phase. It seems like that's the amplitude of the light, which you've squeezed.
I mean, you actually don't squeeze the light going into the detector. You put squeezed vacuum into the dark port, which cancels out fluctuation. Yeah, exactly, right? So I would need to sit down and prepare for a couple of days. I'm not an expert on that, right? Nurgis is the expert on that. So you need Stefan and Nurgis to really explain that properly.
Okay.
But you know, I'm just laying out the tools that you could use to possibly beat the noise curve limits. So basically, you know, low frequency is facility and suspensions. Intermediate frequencies are thermal, which could be upgraded in a 2.5G experiment. High frequency, you have squeezing basically already in the back pocket to improve the high frequency sensitivity. And the question is, you know, how much can they improve the squeezing between now and when they're actually going to put it in the detectors? But it's been demonstrated broadband first in GEO and now in Hanford. And then you have tuning the signal recycling cavity to look for specific frequencies. But that you definitely do sacrifice the low frequency sensitivity. Because
how does that work? How does that tuning work?
So basically what you're saying, you want the gravitational wave sideband to be resonant in the detector. So you have the carrier light is resonant in the detector, and as the gravitational wave goes past, it puts a phase shift on the carrier light, which is basically putting an audio frequency sideband on. You tune that to be resonant for a specific frequency in the signal recycling cavity.
What type of laser is used?
What type of laser? 1064 nanometer ND YAG power amplified laser, basically. It's a custom laser from LZH in Germany.
Why was that chosen?
So it was chosen, you want a very stable, high power continuous laser. And the 1064 nanometer laser was chosen because you can build, you know, 1064 there was a lot of industrial experience in labs with 1064 nanometer. We understand the optics and the coatings that can do reflectivity at those frequencies. It's broadly used, and you can build stable high power lasers at that sensitivity. I mean, the initial LIGO laser was 12.5 watts operating, 10 watts operating. The advanced LIGO laser is going to be 100 watts. 100 watt continuous laser is a pretty impressive laser, especially at the you need frequency sensitivity, you need frequency stability and power stability of the laser. So in order to build that, that's what we could do. Silicon actually needs a 1.5 micron laser because silicon has a different band gap and so different reflectivities, and so you need a different laser if you're going to go to silicon optics.
How much is the actual kind of vacuum tube? Is it large enough that you could actually have like two separate light paths and two different lasers? Like
physically, it's about that big, just one-to-one scale. So you can have, I mean, you had multiple laser beams going through
at the same time,
yeah. And one of the crazier things that Stefan's kind of thinking about is going back to delay line interferometers, where you have multiple beams reflecting backwards, a hybrid Fabry-Perot delay line type stuff. So he's going to talk about some of the more interesting ideas for pushing sensitivity beyond advanced LIGO in the workshop. Okay, where do I want to go with this? I've been talking for a while.
Yeah, you're at 1 hour.
Yeah.
So are you
going to
talk about calibration?
Sure. Yeah. I kind of didn't prepare much because I wasn't sure what people kind of wanted to know and what the audience was. I mean, calibration is something that comes into a lot of things because accuracy in the calibration basically feeds into accuracy in measuring the phase.
Because I've heard from different people, I've never really understood this, that calibration is a serious source of systematic error, because sometimes one cannot calibrate things better than 10%. One needs to know if that's true and why that's the case, because if you can't measure things better than 10%, that puts in a fundamental limit on how well you can test GR, measure shear mass, whatever.
And that's so calibration, we should probably talk about in a separate, you know, that is an hour talk in and of itself. I mean, what you want to show is basically that if you have errors in the calibration, there's different types of errors in the calibration, right? You can have an amplitude error, which you kind of don't really care about, just sets the, so. Well, if you want to test GR, the thing you care about is basically errors in the phase of the calibration.
Unless there's no modification in the phase, the only correction is just in the amplitude.
No, but say you have a given source, that could be farther or closer, okay, that wouldn't modify the amplitude.
Right, so if that's where electromagnetic counterparts would come in, because if you had a measurement of distance, for example, prior to the inclination angle is, because maybe you saw a short gamma ray burst as well.
Right.
That allows you to get the distance, both gravitational.
Yeah, but think about binary black holes.
But if you, well, forget about binary black holes. Then you have no electromagnetic.
That's right.
Right.
And you're not rattling or shining.
That's right. So we're rattling.
So in that case, if you're telling me that then we don't care about the amplitude, so our calibration errors.
Well, we don't care about amplitude, it's a different thing, right? So what do you care about? There are multiple different things you can care about when you're talking about calibration. The first question is detection, right? How is the calibration accurate enough for detection? If you change the errors in the phase of the calibration, and particularly frequency-dependent errors in the phase of the calibration, will change the phase in HFT, and that's what you're ultimately measuring when you're looking for these signals. So if you change the gravitational wave phase in a way that screws things up, then you might not even detect. We think we have a handle on it we know we have a handle on it to better than the detection level. So then it becomes the parameter estimation level. And there's papers where people have looked at the accuracy of parameter estimation with calibration errors. That I can't cover. I mean, we said this is going to be a half hour talk and I'm already an hour.
I would certainly support to have, I don't know, this would have been next week. Something on calibration errors.
Yeah.
Spend a full hour.
Yeah.
I mean, this is super important.
I agree. No, I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying it's not something I can do justice in, you know, minus 5 minutes. I think we should definitely. I mean, so Salvatore Vitale has a nice paper where. So Bruce's original paper where he looks at the effect of systematic calibration errors on the match filter is worth going through and. You know, can be gone through in 20 minutes, half an hour. Basically shows how errors in the calibration enter into. So for people who don't know what I'm talking about, the, you know, LIGO actually measures a signal, let's call it E of T on the light. That's not the gravitational wave signal. You have to actually generate a HFT signal, which you can write if you write this in the frequency domain. There's a response function that tells you the response of the interferometer. and you measure this literally by moving the mirrors at a particular frequency and asking what is the output of the gravitational wave, what is the error signal if you move the mirrors at a particular frequency, and you sweep through a sequence of frequencies, you do a step measurement, and that plus knowledge of the cavities of the interferometer tell you how to construct this response function to calibrate the data coming out of the instrument. And so errors in this can translate into errors in the gravitational wave signal measure.
Is the response continually measured? I mean, is it something that's changing all
the time? It changes because it varies. The part of it is fixed, which is the optical design of the interferometer. Part of it changes because it varies depending on the power in the arms. But it is monitored by calibration lines that monitor that at specific frequencies continuously. So it's continually updated to reflect the state of the instrument. But there's, you know, there's errors in doing that. But calibration is something we should definitely talk about. I'm trying to think what, I mean, I haven't touched at all on the data analysis of what we do once we get H of T. That's probably, I mean, what, so calibration is what people want to hear. We haven't talked anything about the analysis.
I can kind of couple it in with a talk on how do you measure parameters. And
yeah. I haven't talked anything about sky localization.
You said something about triangulation.
Yeah, basically triangulation. Sky localization is triangulation. And the two key places the noise curve comes in are the everywhere, right? Because it's sensitive to the detector. But the the canonical numbers you'll hear. Oh, I know what I was going to talk about, which is basically how do we get from where we are now to, you know, what's the timeline for these detectors? It's triangulation is where most information comes from.
So then if you have the two LIGO detectors with the exact same orientation, same, and then there are directions in which you would have, no, they wouldn't measure anything. And then with the other one, with the Virgo, you wouldn't be able to, you have only one left and you cannot do a triangulation like it for exactly that, right?
Hang on, say that again, Mama.
So you have some direction for which you wouldn't measure anything, right?
You have null directions for the two.
Right, you have null directions.
So then these two are
might be the only thing to see in a particular cycle.
Yes. Yeah, so in fact, the. Right.
So. I see. So, what do you do about that?
Well, the null is basically, so if you think about it, so you have a plane of detectors, right? You have the most sensitivity when, you know, when it's basically above the plane from the triangulation, right? The triangulation, the error in timing basically goes as the way that error feeds in is the. So the error in timing. Let me write that. So if you're going to actually look for the signal, so we're using match filtering, you end up with something that looks like. So that's the signal to noise ratio, right? And if you for a given detector, you can measure the sensitivity to the detector. The typical way we measure the sensitivity to the detectors is by quoting the range of sensitivity. Right, so you ask, there are two numbers that people quote. So given a noise curve for a configuration of a specific detector, you can ask, what's the, how far can that detector see a canonical source, right? So the sensitivity is quoted in two numbers, either what's called horizon distance, and horizon distance is the distance at which an optimally oriented, typically 1.4 solar mass binary neutron star signal would give you a signal to noise ratio of 8. Right? So, so basically you put in a, so you put in a 1.4 1.4 signal, you do the integral and you get a distance out here. Right?
What would that be for advanced LIGO?
So for advanced LIGO, for full sensitivity, actually let me, so D horizon is 2.26 times about 200 megaparsecs. So it's about 440 megaparsecs is the horizon distance. The reason I'm giving you in this funny form is there is another number that is used, which is termed the range. And the range is defined as the volume of a sphere that has the same, sorry, the radius of a sphere that has the same volume of that peanut of sensitivity. Yeah. So the detector is sensitive to some volume that looks like this. And the reason people do it this way is people are interested in rate estimates, and the rate goes as the volume. And if you put this number in, the horizon distance in, as the radius of the sphere to calculate the number of sources, you overestimate the number of sources, and so you construct a different distance, which is a sphere that has the same volume there as V, right? And the difference, the factor between the horizon distance and the range is basically a factor of 2.26, which you get from integrating over the possible angles, integrating over this, and then you actually have to Monte Carlo it because you can't get an analytic number. So you basically have to Monte Carlo the number of sources inside and outside the volume. But this can cause a lot of confusion between people quoting numbers. So the binary neutron star range for advanced LIGO design sensitivity is basically about 200 megaparsecs. I think CAGR have been quoting horizon distances. Everybody is now kind of getting towards the basically using the range rather than horizon distances. Virgo now use range as well.
So when you say optimally marked, you mean optimally located in the sky or both?
Optimal in every way. Okay. So the binary is directly overhead the detector and is face on.
What about the range? The range and optimally oriented the binary range is optimal.
No, the range is averaged over every angle that can change. That's why it can't be done analytically. You actually have to Monte Carlo it.
So this number, it's number 8. So the signal noise 8.
Right.
Where it comes from? What is the realistic? I mean, is that the realistic signal noise that will be needed for advanced LIGO to say? I realize this is for signal noise in one detector, and suppose that if you detect it in multiple detectors. I mean, some ways with the LIGO, they're both the same orientation, so they should have the same. They're both operating. They should have similar sensitivity to a given.
Right.
I'm just
curious,
this number 8 and what?
So the number, this is an interesting question. One thing I've done is I've asked Gabby and Yon-Yves if we can share the fake detection paper that we wrote. Because what rho equals 8 really feeds into is what is your detection confidence in detecting a gravitational wave signal? And so you can say in Gaussian noise in a single detector, where am I prepared to claim a detection, right? Is it, 5 sigma, one in 100,000 years, one in a million years, what's my detection threshold? I can give you the number from the Big Dog paper, which is we would have claimed, evidence for the detection of gravitational waves at 1 in 7,000 years. That for a clean BNS signal in two detectors, if we got 6-6 in two detectors, I think people will be on the edge of saying, this is evidence for two detectors. But exactly what this number is, 8-8 in two detectors, or 8-8 in three detectors, would stick for a binary neutron star signal, would stick above the background like a, it would just, that would be easily be a detection. So then you can, ask, okay, so how low can you push this? How far are you prepared to go in terms of what's detection of, what's evidence for? But we pretty much in the enhanced LIGO analysis, we got the background rate low. The thing that makes data analysis hard is because the data's not Gaussian. It's eliminating all the non-Gaussian stuff. The first thing you have is coincidence between the detectors, because the gravitational wave should be coincident, but the non-Gaussian noise isn't. the transient noise isn't, then you know that gets rid of a certain amount of it, but then you have to actually do more signal processing to eliminate the stuff that you know, it picked up by the match filter but doesn't match the signal exactly, and so on and so forth, and all this type of stuff. And then data quality, just to, I mean, the best way of doing that is fix the instrument and get rid of it, right? So get the instrument as Gaussian as possible. But between a combination of the detector characterization and the analysis, in initial LIGO, we pretty much for binary neutron stars are down at the Gaussian noise limited rate for binary neutron star systems. So then you can, you know, pick what sigma you would, you know, for Gaussian noise.
To get to Gaussian noise, you need at least two, probably at least two detectors.
Oh, absolutely. You one detector on its own, you basically, there's no hope of getting to the Gaussian noise level, even with all the fancy signal processing techniques in the world we can think of.
Sure. So it's, I mean, sometimes it's a little bit deceptive, but it's stating it as one, as a constraint on one interferometer is kind of, because really, I mean, it's anyway, I mean, you gain a lot more by having two or multiple than just the extra statistics you get from
it. If you look at the way the rates are quoted, there's a paper that goes through that goes through the rate predictions, and it quotes it for single detector 8, and that is a conservative number, right? But these rates have an order of magnitude inserted in them anyway. So for binary neutron stars, if you say, you know, rho equals 8. You know, rho equals 8 gives you a detection rate of 40 per year. Your uncertainty in that rate is not whether or not this is 6 or whether or not this is 10. So, but that's basically the sensitivity for that we quote the detections at, because 8 and 2, 3 detectors is a guaranteed detection for the binary neutron star case. For neutron star black hole and black hole, that's not necessarily guaranteed. Then things get more challenging. So.
But if some future detector got rid of all the non-Gaussian entities, and then if you had, you know, SNR 3 in one and 4 in the other, and have 5 total, 2.5 sigma, and be happy. Is that, I mean, is that really the only reason that it's such a, I mean, SNR 8, you know, 8 sigma, often is.
It's not.
Because
we don't use a Gaussian distribution.
It's chi-squared 2. Yeah, it's chi-squared. This is chi-squared 2. It's not. There's more because you're looking for two. You're looking. You have an unknown phase that you're maximizing over. You have basically two filters that you add in quadrature. So it's not Gaussian. It's.
Can I step back? So what is the reason why you need for a binary black hole a higher signal-to-noise equation?
So. Leaving aside any issues of certainty or uncertainty in the waveform, the techniques you use to eliminate the background noise sources for the non-Gaussian noise sources are more powerful the longer the template is. Once you start to get to very short binary black hole, and particularly high masses, you're starting to get to signals that in band are, you know, even when you get to the very short, you know, when you're just seeing merger ring down, are comparable to the types of non-Gaussian stuff you're seeing. So the longer the signal, the more powerful.
The argument you made there with the single-to-noise SNR of 8, that was thinking of the CVC search, right? What would the first people do, or say? What is the criteria for them?
For detection of bursts?
Right.
I don't think...
Well, the search is completely different.
Yeah, I mean, the search is sufficiently different, but...
Of course, well, let's hope this doesn't happen, but everyone working at CBC drops there tomorrow. And there is a strong signal that, I mean, it's there, and then you could see the burst, and they will come out.
Well, again, it comes down to empirically measured false alarm rates, right? I mean, the burst group, the way this is done in practice is you don't... this is probably another... half-hour talk on its own. The way you do this is you measure the signal amplitude and the background amplitude. You don't, when you're doing LIGO searches, you don't say anything above an SNR of 8 is a detection, right? What you do is you measure the background and you compare the distribution of the, we have the disadvantage that you can't turn off our signal. So the way you measure the background is, there are multiple different ways of doing it, but the way it was done in the first science runs is basically to time shift the detectors against each other. So you take the data from Hanford, you take the data from Livingston, and you shift the data by more than the light travel time between the detectors. You reanalyze the data, and so anything that shows up as a coincident signal is not a gravitational wave, it's just chance coincidence of noise artifacts in the data that survive the filtering. And so you do, you know, 100,000, you know, how many of these time shifts you want to do, that gets you a distribution of the signal noise in the background. Then you look at your zero lag coincidence, that gives you your distribution of signal noise in the foreground, and you compare the two against each other. And the burst group, you know, so ultimately then it comes down to a question of, you know, okay, I have the signal sticking out above the background, how far above the background does it need to be to claim detection confidence? And for the burst group, it's going to be, you know, similar false alarm rates to the CBC, I mean, probably higher false alarm rates than the CBC group to actually claim a detection.
I guess what I was trying to ask is, presumably they might have a way to say this is a detection that's not as sensitive to what the source is. It's just, okay.
Oh, sorry, you're asking, so how much, all right, so let me rephrase the question if I understand it correctly. Let's say we're wrong about post-Newtonian theory or something. How much closer would a binary neutral system need to be for the burst group to find it with an unmodeled search rather than the CBC group to find it with an optimal search? Probably a ballpark a factor of two. It's not that, you don't have to get much of, so the burst searches are actually pretty sensitive. You're not talking SNR50, before the, I mean, really, when you get to, you can eyeball this by looking at the looking at time frequency scans of the actual signals, mm-hmm. and it varies depending on the mass distribution as well, right? So for binary neutron stars, the signal is a very large time frequency volume, and so that is more challenging for the burst search to find it. For binary black hole signals, which is probably where you're worried about the CBC group making the biggest mistakes, the power is contained in a smaller time frequency volume, which makes it easier for the burst group to find it. So the big dog signal was actually found by the burst group first because that time frequency volume was small enough that it could be contained, detected by the burst search rather than by the, as well as by the CBC search.
What were the masses of the big dog? Just
it was something weird, like 22-ish, something. So it was actually large black hole, small neutron star. Yeah.
So Duncan, so as a very rough intuition, if I can kind of eyeball it in this time frequency domain, this is roughly the threshold for the first search to make it.
Yeah.
So we probably should go to the next.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else? We essentially asked you questions starting at the beginning. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
Probably not now. I mean, I think that's probably enough to conclude and kind of prompt, you know. Yeah.
I mean, since we mentioned this, can you just say what are the working groups?
So France asked what are the different working groups. So the source groups people are targeting are the compact binary group, which basically uses optimal searches to go after model sources. So anything where you have a waveform model and the signal is reasonably long in band, the compact binary group goes after match filtering. So that's basically binary neutron stars, neutron star black hole, binary black holes, ring downs, intermediate mass ratio in spirals. So anything where there's a signal model, that group goes after. So that includes spinning binaries, which complicate the sort of thing even more. You know, not eccentric binaries yet, but that's something people are worrying about sensitivities to. And then there's the burst group, which basically uses time frequency methods to just look for correlated excess power in the detectors above a signal background and see if there's just any signal, correlated signal power in the detector network that sticks up above the level of the background. Then there's the pulsar group, which searches for continuous waves, which is kind of out the scope of what we're talking about. Then the stochastic background group, which looks for correlated stochastic signals between the detectors. David,
I just wanted to ask, could you just tell us where we are now in constructing advanced LIGO?
Sure, actually, yeah, that timeline was the last thing I was going to say, yeah. So, so, if you okay, so this is strain per root hertz. Okay, so where we are right now is, so right now it's 2012. So right now, construction of the advanced LIGO detectors is going on. So everything's funded. Basically, facilities construction is happening. Mirrors are being hung. ISI tables are being put in the vacuum chambers. And basically, the construction of the advanced LIGO interferometers is happening right now. Something like 2014, those interferometers will be accepted by the advanced LIGO project as, you know, complete, which means they are built, they are locked. You can, you know, light is resonant in all the cavities in the interferometer, but there's no guaranteed sensitivity at that stage. It's basically, you know, has the advanced LIGO project delivered the interferometer that it promised, but no guarantee of sensitivity. Then what happens is basically a process of commissioning to get down to the design sensitivity. In initial LIGO, that took between 2000 and 2004-5 to get from when the detectors were turned on with whatever sensitivity they had when they were turned on and locked, down to initial LIGO design sensitivity. So it's a roughly 5-year process to get from there. There's reason for optimism for advanced LIGO that we could do it a bit more quickly because, you know, we've done it before. We built initial LIGO. But then on the other side, these are more complicated instruments. We're probing into a frequency band that we haven't looked before, down below 40 hertz, where it's difficult to look for the noise. Probably, I think, you know, if you talk to all the, I would say 2018 to 19 is the time frame for getting to the full, you know, 200 megaparsec advanced LIGO, advanced Virgo design sensitivity. Basically zero detune high power, right? So that's where are you? 1, 2, 3. So the bucket of the noise curve is basically flat between 40 hertz, and so that's 3 × 10⁻²⁴. So that's the zero detune high power noise curve that kind of looks like that, where the bucket lies between about 80 hertz, sorry, 6, 10, 20, 30, 40, about 50 hertz, and about 300-400 hertz. I'll post these actual noise curves in the wiki so you can actually see the correct numbers. In terms of getting down there, so that's zero detune high power, right? So there's a bunch of stuff in there. High power basically means the input laser light's at 100 watts. That's going to be difficult to get to because of stability interferometer. If you have high power, you have lensing the optics because of the absorption, so you have stability control issues, all this type of stuff. And then there's the, you know, possibility of excess control noise at low frequencies because of the tuning of the loops. So that,
when you give the 2018-2019 frame, does this plan for other running for a year or so with a worse noise curve and making the first?
Yeah. So the plan is to, you know, the plan is to basically do a run in stages where you'll have some kind of sensitivity that looks like, you know, you'll have an interferometer that looks like that, where it's a factor of, you know, a few. I'm not going to quote exact numbers because exactly what this is going to be, but, you know, this interferometer will maybe have it. So if this is 200 megaparsecs, the goal will be to start with something that maybe has 50 megaparsec range, something like.
Would that be in 2014 or later? This first time.
That would be so 14 is basically acceptance. Okay. So 2015 is, you know, something like 50 megaparsecs range, which is a factor of 2 better than the enhanced LIGO detectors, right?
So 2014 to 15 is like 1 year. So how does this 1 year of getting something to work compare with the 4 or 5 years that you were putting before of getting?
Well, don't forget. I mean, it wasn't like in 2000 we had science runs between 2000 and 2005.
Right.
The advanced LIGO design science run was S5. It was the fifth science run. So there's basically a plan for, and this is what everyone's arguing about at the moment within the LC, you know, what exactly should this plan be? And it's difficult to write this plan down because, you know, it's difficult to predict exactly what's going on in the future, but you can probably ballpark something like, you know, 50 megaparsecs, 100 megaparsecs, 150 megaparsecs,
so
200 megaparsecs for runs.
I mean, the first time zones are very short.
Yeah.
And then S5 was the first one that was very, very long.
Right.
So when would you expect this first really long time zone? One cannot say because it just depends.
I mean, it's hard to predict, right? I mean, I would say there'll be short science runs at 50 megaparsecs. You know, getting towards, once we get out to 100 megaparsecs, there'll be longer runs. I mean, people are talking about setting a threshold for doing a long run, which is at what point, you know, is a reasonable length of run to get, you know, that at the expected rates you would see one thing, right? So what's VT that if you ran for a reasonable amount of time, you would actually expect to see? My suspicion is, you know, once we get to a sensitivity where a 6-month run would give us a chance of seeing a signal, that will be the first long run.
That's a very tricky decision because you do this after 6 months, yeah, obviously.
Right. I mean, this is why kind of advanced LIGO is being a little bit cagey, you know, with exactly what happens here, because you just don't know what's going to happen. But I mean, there is a plan, right, which is start the detector with low power and, you know, about 10 times excess noise at low frequencies, commission the low frequency control to basically beat this noise down, go from, so this will be like 12.5 watts of input power, I guess 10 watts of input power, 10 watts of input power, go down to, you know, maybe 25 watts, that gets the high frequency down because you're higher power, and then add in signal recycling to shape the noise curve to give you a bit of better binary neutron star range down here, and then... Well, I mean, so what the LSC is doing at the moment, I mean, this is a little bit... The argument in the LSC at the moment that's going on is, what can we say to the outside community that will be useful for planning for particularly, you know, EM observations in the advanced LIGO era? And what we've been working on internally is a document that spells out for different possible commissioning scenarios, because, you know, there's also Virgo in here as well, right? What Virgo has similarities and differences to advanced LIGO. So Virgo is, you know, design Virgo sensitivity is about 150 odd megaparsecs because they have 3 kilometer long arms, not 4 kilometer arms. Virgo isn't doing a big upgrade to their seismic isolations. Initial Virgo had these very good passive seismic isolation systems. They are upgrading their mirrors, they're upgrading their optics, they're upgrading their lasers, so they are doing an advanced LIGO-like upgrade. You know, there are similarities and differences. There's places where they are kind of ahead of us on the suspension side because we haven't tried these active seismic isolation stuff yet, other than HEPI and enhanced LIGO. So, you know, how quickly are they going to progress as well is an open question. Once I think we have a plausible commissioning scenario, it's very easy then to turn that into ranges, and then the bandwidth of the detector tells you the timing accuracy. You can turn the bandwidth into a timing accuracy so you can get sky localization. So, you know, we have a document that where, you know, we have a Python code that you push a button with noise curves and it gives you, you know, ranges and sky localization plots. But the question is, you know, what noise curves should we put in there? Initial things, you know, talking to David Shoemaker initially, he was talking about noise curves that didn't use signal recycling until later on, because signal recycling complicates the optical topology, extra control loops. Talking to Lisa and David recently, David Fritschel and Lisa Barsotti, the plan might be to put signal recycling in earlier than, you know, some of the original discussions, because it allows you to push down in this region here and get better binary neutron star sensitivity. I mean, I think what's going to happen is advanced LIGO will be optimized to maximize the binary neutron star sensitivity, bottom line. And the quickest path to getting down there is what will happen. Exactly how that will happen depends on, you know, if signal recycling turns out to be finicky in the 4 kilometer detectors, then maybe it will be dropped for later on. If it turns out to be easy because we've done it in GEO and done it in the 40 meter, it'll be put in earlier. So exactly, you know, what this commissioning plan is somewhat in flux. So the idea is to put this document out as a living document that, you know, here's our best guess as of today, and we'll update this as we go forward and get closer to 2018-2019. LIGO India, you know, best guess I would say 2022 for LIGO India to be operating at design sensitivity. So, you know, for a three detector network, it's going to be Hanford, Livingston, Virgo until, you know, 2022 is India timescale, and probably, you know, Kagra sometime between here and here.
So this question of how long these intervals are going to be is kind of awkward, because the initial LIGO, you had no idea, right? You had no idea what was out there. Now you have the constraint of enhanced LIGO not seeing anything, and then S5 not seeing anything. So it seems like, or like the 50 megaparsec, if you want to actually have a science run that you hope to see something, you want to run for like 3 months of science time, which was like 6 months of real time. If it's, I guess you hope you have a higher duty cycle this time, but who knows? So, and it seems kind of unlikely that they're going to do 6 month intervals during this commissioning stage, doesn't it? My worry is that they won't actually do a long, like all these other runs you have here will be like a month, and then they won't really do, let the thing go for a year or what have you until they reach, you know, 2018.
I don't think that's a concern, because so there's two things, right? There's in the perfect world, right, where your detector is completely Gaussian and you don't have any issues, you just build, you just keep commissioning till you hit your design sensitivity and then you run. But the bottom line is, you know, there are two things that come in practice. First is you need to actually understand the detectors and when they're in data taking mode, and to do that you need to take a reasonable amount of data. The commissioners also hit a point where they can sometimes hit a brick wall and say, you know, we're kind of stuck. We need to think about this. And that happened in initial LIGO. And so, you know, running for a longer time, you know, while they consider various different options for commissioning is not implausible. So I don't think we'll be in a situation where we see, like, you know, 2 week runs, you know, until we hit 2018, 2019 design sensitivity. I think there's going to be a, you know, my suspicion is there'll be, you know, month runs, then 3 month runs, then 6 month runs, then maybe a year run, and then as you get down to design sensitivity. I don't think it's going to be nothing until here. I don't think taking the attitude that, you know, we're not going to even analyze the data at all until we can guarantee a detection is particularly sensible, because you're not going to understand your detector if you do that. And so there's going to be, you know, interspersed between here, there's commissioning periods, there's science runs, and then there's, you know, observing once we've detected stuff.
How long is the schedule? Because I remember in the past people were telling me that, you would reach design sensitivity around 2017, now is it 2018, even 2019? I mean, is this now the final, let's say, schedule? I mean, since we are in a period of...
Can you sign
here?
it's everything under control.
if you were to ask me to... And not speaking as a member of the LSC, but if you had to ask me to bet my own money on when advanced LIGO will hit design sensitivity, I believe that number,
2018-2019.
If you had to bet your own money, when do you think you'd
get the first
detection?
That's a real question. I don't
know.
That depends
on rates, too. Yeah. I don't think he needs to be betting on
it. He has to fold a lot of information.
How much do you trust Elia? So
that's why I asked him.
Well, it's a.
Let me try that.
It's difficult to tell, right? I mean, it depends on the rates. There's an order of magnitude uncertainty in those rates.
Sure.
I mean, I hope. You know.
You have to wait until the design is basically right?
Yeah.
If you're a pessimist, you have to wait for 200 megaparsecs. Is it 200 megaparsecs with the lower interval of the rate, like the 5% bit?
It's four per year, yeah.
That's essentially what I was asking. What I was asking Duncan is whether he thinks we need to wait until we get to the same sensitivity to see something or not.
I think
he didn't want to say it.
So well, all right, so let me rephrase that. If you want to be making, you know, real constraints on the rates that people will actually like still would be interested in, then I think you do need to wait for a couple of years of running at design sensitivity. I think if you don't see something, If you don't see something with shorter runs at these sensitivities, then you can always turn around and say, well, the rates are on the lower end.
Yeah.
Right? The rates are on the lower end, tough luck. I think if you run for, you know, two calendar years at design sensitivity, which is 1 year of integrated running, if we assume a duty cycle of 50% for all three detectors, and you don't see anything in two calendar years of running at design sensitivity, then, well, the lower end of the rates say you should have seen four.
And you put a lot of people in suicide watch.
So,
what about the pulsar continuous signals? Like, what are they expected to do?
I think the pulsars are pretty challenging to go after, even at design sensitivity for advanced LIGO. I think you need several years of observing before you get down to the expected rates for the.
It's a Murray model dependency.
Yeah. I'm not expert enough. I mean, I.
Like RMOs.
Yeah, I'm not expert enough on the pulsar sources to basically give you a concrete number, but I don't think it's, you know, a case of, I'm pretty sure it's, you know, 2 years of running at advanced LIGO sensitivity, you'll be seeing pulsars. They're lower than that because it's model dependent. You'll be beating spin downs, but the gravitational wave emission is probably a lot lower than the spin down limit, because of magnetic braking, whatever. So, I mean, the quote that I've heard is basically advanced LIGO is a machine for detecting binary neutron stars. I mean, that's how the noise curve was designed. The NSF,